Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. At the end of the program today, we're going to be speaking with John Greenspan, the jazz man. I'm very happy now to welcome Al Bronstein. He is Director Emeritus of the National Prison Project of the ACLU. He's President of Penal Reform International for the Americas, among many other organizations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
How did you get involved in the whole big issue of prisons?
Well, during the 1960s, I was running a civil rights legal program in the South, in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Georgia, and North Florida. Given the kind of work I was doing, I was in and out of jails and prisons just about every day. Civil rights workers getting locked up, getting arrested for walking on the wrong side of the sidewalk or for carrying a sign saying freedom now. That's a horrible crime in Mississippi back in the 1960s. So I spent a lot of time there, and I was in the South. I left in 69, went to Harvard for the rescue, and then went back to wind things up as the picture was changing in the South. So there were some black lawyers had come on the scene, some few white lawyers were willing to handle civil rights cases. There was no need anymore for this special operation that we had put together in 1964. And so I was in the South when the Attica uprising happened in September of 1971, the terrible thing in New York at the Attica prison in upstate New York, when a lot of people were killed, both guards and prisoners, as a result of the foolishness of the governor who sent in untrained state police to end the disturbance, and they just shot everyone they saw. In any event, a number of foundations became concerned about reports that were coming out about the problems of America's prisons after the Attica Commission report came out. And they called the ACLU and said, which had two small little projects at the time, one in New York and one in Virginia, run by local branches of the ACLU. And they said, we think the ACLU ought to be doing something a little larger than this. And I got a call from the then director of the ACLU. And I went up to Washington and we met and decided to put together a national project, merging those two small projects and taking on some of their staff. And we located in Washington, and the rest, as they say, was history. And it's still going.
Well, the great question that was raised at that point is whether prisoners have rights under the Constitution.
That's right. I mean, the law had been pretty bad. There was a case in the 1890s in Virginia which basically found that prisoners had no more rights than slaves. And that was basically the attitude of the courts all through the early part of the 20th century, even into the 1960s. And then finally, as the makeup of the Supreme Court began to change a little and some of the lower courts, federal courts, changed, there were some different kinds of decisions coming down. And then we, in 1974, tried a case in Alabama. We were looking at really trying to find the underlying problems with prisons. Instead of sort of picking out one little thing after another, things that you couldn't really enforce unless you had a lawyer in the prison 24 hours, for example, having notice of what the disciplinary rules were before you were brought up on charges. Well, if you didn't have a lawyer in the room when they were being charged with something, there was no way of enforcing those early rules that were promulgated by the courts. And we were looking for a case that might sort of really get to the heart matter, and that was prisons were actually making people worse. That had to be a violation of the Constitution. And coincidentally, we were looking at one of the southern states, Alabama or Mississippi, when a 75-year-old African-American man wrote a handwritten complaint to the chief federal judge in Montgomery, Alabama, Frank Johnson, a Republican, by the way, a very good judge. I had tried some civil rights cases before him in the 60s, and he was always very fair and so on. In which this elderly man said, I've been in and out of Alabama's prisons for the last 40 years, and they ain't done nothing for me. Basically, that's what it was, a handwritten letter. And Judge Johnson had gotten a lot of mail from prisoners, and so he called upon a law professor at the University of Alabama, appointed him counsel in the case, and said, this case be heard, and he said, I want you to get some help. And he recommended that he contact me at the Prison Project. So we went down there for a meeting, and it was agreed that Judge Johnson would appoint us to be part of the case, and we proceeded, and in fact, proved that the entire system was making people worse, and he entered a very broad set of relief, including promoting standards for the operation of the prisons, appointing an investigating team of local citizens to visit all the state prisons in Alabama and file reports with the court. He basically took control of the prison system with a finding that prison conditions were making people worse. That was a violation of the Eighth Amendment. And from then that spread to other parts of the country, and by our 15th anniversary, I just checked earlier today, we had 27 states under court order, either their entire state prison system or one or more major prisons in the state. 27 states plus the Virgin Islands were under court order in the case that we had brought. So there was clearly a need to... Basically, we were running 19th century prisons in this country in the 20th century.
There's a great philosophical difference that persists to this day between those who believe in punishment and those who believe in rehabilitation and dealing with the reasons that the crimes were committed in the first place. What are the roots of our current prison system, and how do those philosophical differences play out?
Well, unfortunately, what's driving prison population in this country today is money. Let me give you a little background. First of all, you have to recognize that today we now have 25% of the entire world's jail and prison population in the United States. With less than 5% of the world's population, we have a quarter of the incarcerated population, which by itself is a shameful bit of information. And we're not, you are much safer to walk in Washington or New York at night than you are these days to walk in London, Paris, Rome, or Madrid. There's more crime going on in those cities than there are in cities and major cities in the States. So it's just a system that has gotten out of control, and part of it was driven by the development of the private prison companies, like Corrections Corporation of America, like Wackenhut, which is now called GEO, and half a dozen others, who are making tens of millions of dollars by running prisons. They don't have any union employees. They pay very low wages. One of these companies, which is in New Mexico, actually, was running jails in New Mexico, Wackenhut. They were able to run them fairly cheaply for the state, but make a lot of profit because they were hiring correctional officers as guards, people who'd been fired by the Texas Department of Corrections for unnecessary use of force. Well, if you're fired by Texas, then you're a real man. mean person, and they were hiring them and putting them in charge of prisons in New Mexico. So that's partly what's driving it. It's become a big business. It's gotten out of control. We forgot about parole. We forgot that part of the great burden on people running prisons is to get people to come back into society in a meaningful way. Instead of that, we created all kinds of barrier to reentry. For example, in one state we dealt with, Kentucky, the only work program they had in the state prison for a while was how to learn to be a master barber. When you got out of prison in Kentucky, you couldn't become a master barber. You couldn't get a license if you had a criminal record. And that kind of symptom you find throughout the state, we put up all kinds of barriers to reentry. First of all, we locate our prisons as far away from the community as possible, so that it's very difficult for poor families to visit them. We don't know a lot about recidivism, but one thing we know is that the maintenance of close family ties is important for a person coming out of prison so that they won't recidivate again. If they have close family ties, they're less likely to commit another offense. Well, we break down family ties because we put our prisons all over the country and away from visiting and so on. We've abolished most of our in-prison programs. There are very few school programs anymore, any work programs, with a few exceptions. Minnesota, state of Minnesota is an exception on that. And we create all kinds of barriers to reentry. For example, if you have a history of a drug offense, you can't get housing in a federal housing program. Or if anyone in your family had a drug offense, you can't get apartment in one of these federal housing complexes. Now, that's beginning to change. The Congress this past term enacted something called the Second Chance Act, recognizing that we want to work to get people back into society in a manner in which they won't feel the only thing they have open for them is to commit another crime.
We're talking to Al Bronstein of the National Prison Project of the ACLU. It seems that we've lost, I don't even hear this kind of language anymore, the idea that somebody pays their debt to society when they've done their time, and then they're done. It seems like, and I know that there are good reasons for this, but people, for example, have to register as sex offenders, and they can't vote, and there are so many things after they get out where they never stop paying, and it makes it very difficult for them to actually get a job and become a productive citizen again.
Well, you mentioned the lack of the ability to vote. That's a hangover from the slavery. It's a hangover from Reconstruction in this country. The legislation that was passed in the 1890s after blacks were liberated by the 13th Amendment to the Constitution and could vote and began to elect black officials in some of the southern states. The southern states panicked, and they enacted these laws saying you can't vote once you've committed a felony. And it becomes permanent in many states, or it becomes so difficult to get the right to vote back that people can't even bother trying to do it. Now, so you take a person who's come out of, maybe they spent 7 years in prison, and they're being treated like a criminal still on the streets. They have trouble getting a job. They can't get a job. They have a record. They can't vote. All they can do is steal. And so we're in so many areas we're encouraging the commission of crime as the only alternative available to people coming out of prison.
As probably many of our listeners know, the prison population is very imbalanced racially. There are way more black and Latino people in prison proportionally than their white counterparts. Why
not
is
just
that?
Proportionally, but without any relationship to the amount of black or Hispanic crime.
Yeah, so say more about that.
Well, blacks particularly sentenced to prison in such numbers that bear no relationship to the amount of crime committed by African Americans. Very simple, what happens if a young black teenager gets arrested, charged with stealing a bicycle. He's going to come before a judge. He's going to say, well, I'm not going to let you out on the street. You might do something bad. So you can't make no bail for you. You stay in until you get sentenced. Comes up to sentencing, the sentencing judge says, well, you spent your time in jail. You must be a bad actor, so I'm going to give you a real tough sentence. A white middle-class person does something. They immediately make bail. So when they get back into court, the likelihood of them getting a very low sentence or no sentence at all is much greater than it is if you're a black person. And, you know, racism still pervades the entire criminal justice system. It's dominated by white people, and it's just a sick system. And it's growing that way for Latinos now as well.
What about the proportion of violent to nonviolent crimes? We've talked on this program before a number of times about how many people are in jail, for example, for nonviolent drug offenses, possession of marijuana, possession
right.
of small amounts of drugs, things like that. That's a significant portion of our prison population.
Great majority of our prison population are in there for victimless crimes involving the use of drugs or the sale of drugs, particularly marijuana. But even others, and for example, even there, we've had something that's just been eliminated by Congress, but for years, typical black drug, which is an inner-city black drug, compared to pure cocaine, crack, which is a black drug, the sentences were 100 times greater than if you were caught with pure cocaine, which is a white suburban drug. So people were getting enormous sentences if they were inner-city blacks because they had a small amount of crack cocaine. Now, that's just been fixed by law passed in Congress. So we're beginning to get some more sensible discussion about these things. There is a lot of hope. I mean, in the last year and a half, 21 states have changed their policies in some way to have a more rational criminal justice system. By some ways, I mean things like eliminating mandatory minimum one-year sentence for possession of one marijuana cigarette. California was the first state to do that, saving themselves $200 million. Even after they put up the money to have community treatment drug programs, they still saved $200 million by not having a person serve a year in jail minimum, a year in state prison minimum for having one marijuana joint. And a number of states have now abolished those mandatory minimum things. And as I say, there are 21 states, including New Mexico. New Mexico's one little contribution to this was the abolition of the death penalty. I mean, I think that was in great part driven by the cost, trying to enforce the death penalty. But New Mexico has some other things to work on, too. But the movement in the country today is a recognition that one of the biggest line items on the annual state budget is corrections. Michigan, a state which is almost bankrupt, they had me come there and meet with the governor's staff last year and with a whole bunch of Republican members of the legislature to talk about alternatives to incarceration. They realized they just were bankrupting the state with their state prison system, and they've begun to make changes there. I just had to point out their neighbor, Canada. You can practically jump across the river in Detroit and be in Canada. Canada is a country very similar to ours. Sometimes we tend to compare, look at Denmark and Finland and Sweden, and people say, those are small countries, they're old countries, they're different. And you can't say that about Canada. Canada is a young country, as we are. They have a significant African-American population, an African population. They have a significant immigrant population. They have an aboriginal population, both Eskimo and Indian. Their crime rates are very similar to ours, with the exception of handgun homicides. They had very strict gun control after they abolished the death penalty. And yet we incarcerate six times as many people as they do per capita. And that convinced the people in Michigan that they had to make some changes. So I'm very hopeful, but I've always been hopeful.
Well, one of the things that I've read people say is, the crime rate has gone down while the rate of incarceration has gone up, and those two things are related. You incarcerate more criminals, there's less crime. How do you respond to that?
That's not true. Crime rate did not go down dramatically as the incarceration rate increased dramatically. It was continuing to go up. It's only very recently that it's begun to go down, and there are other factors that explain it. As the prison population began to go down, which it has in the last 3 or 4 years, crime rates have gone down a little, too. There really is no real evidence that incarceration is a crime control factor.
You have looked at prisons all over the world, not just in the United States, and have found some conditions far, far worse than what we have in the U.S. and some in Scandinavian countries far better. Tell us about what you've seen.
Well, I've seen in some poor countries, Brazil, Malawi and sub-Saharan Africa, where hundreds and hundreds of prisoners are just sleeping on the floor. They have no beds, they have no ventilation, they have no starving there. In fact, wearing my international hat, we did some work in Malawi because the country was so poor they couldn't feed their prisoners. We brought in some British farmers. The government gave us land by each of the four major prisons. These farmers taught the prisoners how to plant crops, rotate crops, train the prisoners on how they're feeding themselves. It also gives them an opportunity, a job to learn, so that when they get out of prison, they can become farmers. And then we did a study and found that 80% of the prisoners, they were pre-trial. The system breaks down. They know how to arrest them, but they don't know how to process them or try them. Many of them have been there longer than any sentence they could have gotten. So we began a program to train prisoners on how to do paralegal work. And pretty soon we were able to get out. The first year was, 1,200 prisoners were released. They'd already served their time. And 1,000 prisoners a year after that. So it really made a difference. Well, in Brazil, I've been in prisons in Rio de Janeiro, which is a fairly wealthy city, a police lockup where there were prisoners stacked three high. So there was this one group of prisoners in a big, large room that may have been big enough for 25 people. They had 100 prisoners, 25 lying on the floor in little mats, and halfway up the wall they had a series of hammocks suspended from the walls filled with prisoners, and then up at the ceiling they had another layer of prisoners in hammocks. It's just outrageous, spreading disease and awful kind of stuff. On the other hand, you go to prisons in some countries, the Scandinavian countries and some parts of the United Kingdom and parts of France and Germany, where prisons are geared towards reentry. They focus not on punishment. The punishment is being removed from your family and your society, but that's the end of the punishment. From then on, they're working on how to bring you back in as a law-abiding citizen. So they try to have as much visiting as possible with family, have job programs in the maximum security prison in Denmark, a new one that I visited, the big furniture factory there where all the prisoners work. You can always get a job when you get out of prison in Scandinavia if you know how to build furniture. The prisoners cook their own food. They have a market in the that comes in 3 afternoons a week that sells food in the prison. Prisoners are buying because they're getting paid for their work in the factory. There's a little bank thing there. Even though it's a maximum security prison, the maximum security is really they're not at home. And the rest of it, they try to make it as much like the real world as possible, because when you want to go back, it's very difficult to go back. I used to hire former federal prisoners in the 1980s and early 1990s. We hired a number of federal prisoners to work as paralegals in our office, basically to handle prison mail, because they really understood it. And we were getting a lot of mail from federal prisoners. And the first time they went to a grocery store with money in their pocket, they panicked, every one of them, and I was running out of the store, because they hadn't done that in 15 years or 18 years. So we have to make our prisons more like home, have more visiting, more community release kinds of things. It can be fixed, and fortunately, the movement is turning that way right now. As I said before, 22 states have made some changes. The big problem is still these private corporations that they make their money when they have all the beds full. We had a statement from the Corrections Corporation of America, was running the, I think they still run the women's prison, state prison in New Mexico. My office was litigating a Mexico statewide prison case, the Duran case, back in the 1980s, together with a bunch of very competent local lawyers in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque. And we had an officer from the women's prison who voluntarily gave us a written statement, that was run by CCA, saying that he sat on the disciplinary board that held little trials if a woman was charged with committing a disciplinary offense. The warden said, if you find the woman guilty, take away maximum good time, because every 6 months of good time you take away is $16,000 more profit for us. And that's what these private prisons are in it for. They're not interested in, they don't want to release prisons, they want to keep them there because they make more money the more beds they have full.
And does that money come from the taxpayers? Is that who's paying their $16,000, paying those bills?
Well, you and I aren't paying it. Yeah, the government is paying, the state is paying CCA to run the prison, and they have to do that out of the state taxes.
Now, another issue.
And it's a big mythology that they create jobs and so on. You have this state prison that they. A small town in Montana, I don't know if you've seen it in the papers, it's been in a lot of press over the last 2 years. It was built in a small town in northwest Montana as a capital investment. The smallest town spent $20 million building this prison, thought they were going to be able to lease it out, and none of the private companies wanted it until some company came in from California, which turned out to be a fake company. The president of the company was actually wanted by the police himself. He's now in prison, and they paid them to try to run the prison, and they couldn't even run it. They wasted some more money. So it's it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I mean, in the circumstances under which the private prison corporations then lobby conservative legislators to have stronger sentencing laws for their own, so that they can increase their own profits, just creates a cycle of corruption, which is so obvious and so profound.
Well, I was in the New Mexico legislature some years ago in the 1980s when a lobbyist for Corrections Corporation of America got up to speak against having good time for prisoners, time off for good behavior. and gave all kinds of phony arguments, but the real thing was they wanted him to stay in prison longer. And of course, there was at that point, at one point, there was a senator in the state, I don't remember his name, who was a big supporter, a big opponent to the whole idea of private prisons. And then one day I read the newspaper back here in Washington that, I forget which, I think it was Wackenhut, had just gotten a contract in New Mexico, and I called local council in Santa Fe and said, what's happened there? I said, well, it turns out that Senator so-and-so was a paid a board member of Wackenhut. And that's the story throughout the country, where you find members of the state legislature supporting privatization, they're on the payroll in some way.
And of course, it makes it more likely. You gave earlier the example of the people they hire being the people who were too brutal for the Texas
right.
correctional system. It also, I mean, if they want to pay the lowest possible wages to maximize their profits, they're not going to get necessarily the best employees.
That's right. I had 85 women, former clients of mine, women from Hawaii, who were in the Corrections Corporation of America prison in western Kentucky. No visiting there, you know, families in Hawaii, they can't afford to go to fly across the ocean and then across the country to Kentucky. And the women have now been moved out, because significant numbers of them were being raped by the correctional officers. And there are, I think there are pending charges now by the state of Kentucky against, I think, 18 of the correctional officers have been charged with rape. You hire the bottom of the barrel, you get the bottom of the barrel.
Women prisoners also face some other problems, which is that some of them are in prison basically for killing in self-defense, killing partners
right.
who had abused them, or being the partners of, for example, drug dealers.
Or were abused as children, sexually abused by people in the family or friends and so on. There's a lot of evidence that most women in prison are there because of a history of nasty behavior on the part of other people in their bringing up. And then, one of the Hawaii women happens to be a woman who was being abused and tortured by her husband, and she finally lost control, and she borrowed a gun and shot him. And she's serving a long sentence there. So it's, there are many countries that they don't even have women prisons. They're just totally inappropriate. I mean, some of the smaller Scandinavian countries.
Now, it's mandated by the Constitution that every person have legal representation, even if they can't afford it. Is that system working in the U.S.?
Not right now, it isn't. Georgia's system is broke. The public defender doesn't have the money to... They're not trying many cases because they can't afford to hire investigators and so on. Dade County, Miami is also a place where the system is broken down because they don't have the money to hire the lawyers they need for the poor people. It's mainly poor people who are going through jail. There's not a lot of rich people going in. And Texas is having problems raising the money for their public defender system. So it's a very unhealthy situation right now.
So when you look at the overall picture and you look at the cost of prisons, both the financial cost and the social cost, what are the alternatives that are both more compassionate and cheaper for society?
Well, I've got a list here. One of my colleagues is a Deputy Solicitor General in Canada, and he was involved in, developing all the alternatives to incarceration in Canada back in the 1970s. What was happening in Canada, their incarceration rate was growing up to 130 per 100,000, which would bring them at the high end for Western Europe. They don't compare themselves with us. They think we're hopeless. They compare themselves with Western Europe, and they just got very upset. So they, in the 1970s, they passed a whole bunch of legislation so that now their incarceration rate is going down. The down left I saw was 113 per 100,000. We're at 766, six times as high, with similar crime rates. But they have things like diversion programs, appropriate cases that are diverted from the formal system by police or prosecutors, including among diversion outcomes, a restitution where there's an acceptance of responsibility on the part of personal or personal service work for the victim, community service, victim offender mediation, and so on. Probation is another one. Day fines or fines are used frequently in Canada for certain kinds of offenses. Fines compared with restitution programs. Community service is another one. Then they have a thing called conditional sentences, where in every case where the judge feels that the maximum term of imprisonment would be 2 years, the judge has the option of saying, well, that 2 years can be, instead of spending it in prison, it can be satisfied by serving the sentence in the community and in a variety of different programs where you would do some community work, report to a probation officer, serve the sentence in the community where it doesn't endanger the safety of the community, and in any event, and it saves money and doesn't create bad habits, and the system is working. And there are a whole bunch of other things they have that they're doing there, too, various kinds of alternatives. Minnesota is one state that has been doing some of that for many years. Back in the early 1970s, Minnesota enacted a statute which provided that if a county wanted to try a prisoner in court and have it with the result of the imposition of a state sentence for the prisoner, the county had to pay for the incarceration. On the other hand, if the county would develop a total program of dealing with offenders in the county, halfway house, drug program, a jail too, but mainly programs that dealt with alternatives to incarceration, the state pays the county a certain amount of money. So it's in the county's best interest to keep the offenders in the county where they're closer to their home, family, where they may not have to give up their job to do the whatever program they're in, and the likelihood of recidivism is much less, and it works. So the other thing they've done in Minnesota, in the maximum security prison, in the medium security prison, they have companies like one of them is the Toro manufacturing. People make lawnmowers. They built a factory in one of the prisons with real machines, real equipment. They train the prisoners. They pay the prisoners wages for working there. They promise them a job if they do the job in prison successfully. Well, they get a job when they get out. Prisoners get to use the money to pay room and board for their incarceration, have money to send to the family, to the wife or parents, which keeps it off, keeps them out of welfare programs. The labor unions were first opposed to this, but they finally, a very thoughtful commissioner of corrections at the time said, well, look, speaking to the labor unions, if without this program, these guys will come out, they won't have jobs, and they'll be robbing your members. This way, they'll come out and join your union. So the labor unions got on board. And then there's another company that makes, one of the companies that's involved in telephone stuff that makes wires and other stuff. They put a factory in one of the other prisons in Minnesota, and it's working there too. They're training prisoners, they're having fruitful experiences, and they're getting out and getting back, going right into jobs. So it can be done.
Yeah, very interesting. All of these programs. When you look at the big picture, not only on dealing with crime in a more productive way, but actually preventing it. Leaving aside victimless crimes and drug offenses, which are their whole own story, but other things like burglary and gang membership and violent crime and things like that. What would a society that was really working hard to prevent those crimes in the first place look like, do you think?
Well, there's one, Rhode Island is a state that I spent a lot of time on. We have 25 years of litigation there in a very small state. And that was more the problem with the state government that was involved at the time and the incompetence of the state prison directors. So now they've got a very decent professional prison director, and they did a study a couple of years ago, and they found that 80% of their offenders on release from prison went back to two wards in South Providence. 80%, they came from those two wards in South Providence, which South Providence has half the population of the state. So they put together a program where everyone going back into the community has a one-on-one relationship with somebody from this combination of organizations. The ACLU is involved, the NAACP is involved, the church groups are involved, a whole bunch of do-gooder groups. And everyone puts up people so that every prisoner coming back has a one-on-one relationship with some member of one of these groups who's their sort of their buddy, make sure they have a place to live, make sure they help them get a job, follows through with them on a daily basis. How you doing, Charlie? Everything okay? Got any problems? Let me know. And it's working. The recidivism rate is going down. It's practically a very low-cost operation. It just requires some thought. There are many different ways of approaching this kind of stuff. But we just can't bury people in prisons and then forget about them, because most of them are going to come back out, and we want them coming out in better shape, and we want them to have a chance when they come out and not be shoved back into prison.
I find it fascinating and kind of heartening that after all the many, many years, decades that you've been doing this work, that you are hopeful and seeing all these. I guess you are seeing some of these real positive examples.
That's right. Well, I see these two reports, and by the way, your listeners can get copies of the two reports that are published by the Sentencing Project in Washington. Their website is whatever you call that thing, is www.sentencingproject.org, and these are both published this year, just a few weeks ago. One is called The State of Sentencing 2009 Developments in Policy and Practice, and the other one is called Downscaling Prisons, Lessons from Four States, and both by the Sentencing Project. And I think you can get them for free if you just call online. You ask for it, and they'll send it to you. But it really shows that things are changing, and in fact, our incarceration rates have just begun to go down now for the first time. We're still the most recent figures I saw came that we're always 2 years behind. The 2008 figures came out just a few weeks ago from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. We have 2.3 million prisoners in state, federal, and immigration detention facilities. We have 92,000 juveniles, and still 25% of the entire world's prison population. But the overall number has begun to go down a little. So I think we'll begin to see more of that.
Are you looking at the incarceration of immigrants and immigrant detention centers and things like that outside of the local and state prison and federal prison system?
Yeah. In two respects, ACLU has an immigration project, which has an office in New York and the national ACLU, and an office in the West Coast. And then many of the states, the state of Georgia has four immigrant detention facilities in the state, all run by private companies. So the state of Georgia has an immigration project, because that's one of the states I'm still working in. My hat now is as a consultant to the ACLU's affiliate support department. So Georgia is one of the states I'm working in. Texas has a program. New Mexico has New Mexico has an office down in Las Cruces that does nothing but immigration detention work. And have just filed a lawsuit against the facility down on the coast there, down on the border with Texas down there. So there's a great deal of interest. And I tell you that my youngest daughter is an immigration lawyer.
Well, it's I think such an important issue, because many people don't know. I mean, we're sort of going back to the early 20th century all over again, that immigrants actually have constitutional rights, whether or not they're here with papers.
That's right. And there are thousands and thousands of immigrants who are in jails or prisons, mainly run by private companies like CCA and Wackenhut, for months and years when they've not committed any other offense except to be here illegally. That's no other offense. And the maximum they can be held is 6 months. And they're there for a year or two. And on the first day and after 6 months, you can get habeas corpus writ signed by a federal judge if you have a lawyer to file it. And that's a lot of what the ACLU is doing now, because they can't find countries to take them back, or they forget about them. And we have that detention facility on the Texas down near the Mexican line, where they were housing just kids, families in terrible. I mean, these kids were in jail cells. I mean, little infants in jail cells. Horrendous stuff. And when someone from the United Nations came to look at it, they wouldn't let them in. That was a CCA facility there.
Before we go, tell us more about Penal Reform International.
Well, as I said, it was organized by the ACLU as one of their national projects in 1972. They have a new director who's just started beginning of February, who was a lawyer that hired him back in the 80s, and then he went back to the West Coast for a while, and I hired him again in the early 90s. And he was very good, and he stayed there until about 3 years ago, and then went to work. He was looking for a little bit of a change, and he went to work at Human Rights Watch as the head of U.S. programs in Human Rights Watch. But then when the current director retired earlier this year, David Hoppe came back, applied for a job, and was rehired. He's a superb lawyer and a superb human being. He's building the staff back up right now. There was a little bit of a reduction of the staff because of the economy, but he's building it up. And he's going to be doing not just litigation about conditions of prisons, but also the kinds of things that I was talking about before, meeting with state legislatures, trying to take advantage of the current mood in the country that we need to look for ways of saving money, and one way to save it is to cut down on your prison population. So he'll be doing a lot of policy work, and the organization is flourishing.
Al Bronstein is the Director Emeritus of the National Prison Project of the ACLU and President of Penal Reform International of the Americas. If people are interested in this and they want to get involved in some way or find out more, what do you suggest that they do?
Well, they could write to the Immigration Project of the ACLU, or they could write to the National Prison Project. National Prison Project is in Washington. The Immigration Project is based mainly in New York at the national headquarters of the ACLU. And they could get the information from... They're in New Mexico. They can just call the local ACLU office. There's one in Albuquerque, the main office. There's one in Santa Fe, branch office, and there's one in Las Cruces. They call there and they get the information of just who they write to and what the address is, and they'll get information.
Al Bronstein, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome John Greenspan. He is the host of Good Morning Jazz, which is Wednesday and Thursday mornings on KSFR. Welcome.
Welcome, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here. Good morning to everybody.
And you are having the 10th anniversary of Good Morning Jazz.
That's really amazing. We did the first broadcast in late April of 2000, and we had a friend of mine, Danny Sheehan, who lives in Cincinnati. Actually, he's a friend of my wife, who suggested the name. I sent out emails to everybody. You kind of had a contest. What would be the best name for this show? And they came up with Good Morning Jazz. So that's how we got the name.
Keep it simple and everybody remembers it.
Yes.
So you call yourself the jazz man. And how did you get interested in jazz?
I actually had some camp counselors when I was about 11 or 12 who were interested in jazz. And then I kind of took it back home with me when I got back to Baltimore. And my family was very supportive of that, and they kind of encouraged me to buy records and listen to it. And I just liked it. And we had some friends in high school. We were not Elvis fans. We liked Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker instead, and that's how we kept it up.
And over the years, who have been some of your all-time favorite jazz artists?
Well, I guess Miles Davis would certainly be one, and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Oscar Peterson, Benny Goodman, Duke Ellington, Count Basie from the swing era. But there are a lot of good people today. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have four Grammy winners on the show, and these are a little more contemporary. Maria Schneider, who is just terrific. She's won a couple of Grammys. Dave Holland, the great bassist. Bill Holman, who actually goes back about 50 years but won a Grammy about 10 years ago. We had him on. And Bobby McFerrin. But there are a lot of good people out there. Keith Jarrett, of course, is another one. And, you know, there are all kinds of good people coming along.
And when you think about how many of those great people end up playing in Santa Fe, it's staggering in a town of this size.
Oh, absolutely. We have had some terrific people here. And, you know, we're a pretty hip town. And you have people like Bruce Dunlap, who for a while was doing the Jazz Festival. And then the Outpost people took over. And you have Lee and Susan Burke and Larry and Jane Hootkin, who do the Friends of Santa Fe Jazz. And they've brought in some excellent people here, too.
And the Bruce Dunlap's space now is called Gig in Santa Fe on 2nd Street. And they do a variety of music, not just jazz, but including jazz. And they've got a kind of small performance space going.
But it's a nice place to go to. You really, you know, there's intimacy with the artist. And Bruce is doing a terrific job.
So, and there are other jazz venues in town. Where else can you listen to jazz in town?
Well, I think one of the main places now, of course, you have to get out Pasatiempo, but we don't have Bumblebee Bob's place anymore, but El Maison has jazz. You have jazz at La Fonda. And, of course, there are jazz things. There are artists that we're bringing in and out. Vanessi's has had a lot of good jazz concerts. The best thing to do is keep up with the various jazz calendars and Pasatiempo, and we try to keep you informed.
Now, you play jazz, and we have a lot of jazz here on KSFR. We're really primarily, during the day, jazz music format. Then in the evenings and weekends, we go kind of wild and play a little bit of everything.
Yes.
But jazz is great on the radio, and there's also something about listening to live music, which adds a dimension that just never quite makes it onto recordings.
Oh, I think it's impossible to get that onto a recording, but I certainly would urge people to go out and, you know, see jazz events when they happen, and we've had some great ones here in Santa Fe.
Now, we also have on your show, Good Morning Jazz, some regular series like Women in Jazz and New Orleans Hour and all kinds of things.
That's correct. I used to do Women in Jazz the first Wednesday of each month. Now it's an hour on Wednesday, and I work women more into the playlist because there are just more women out there doing things, and it's not such an oddity anymore, and it shouldn't be. I also have an artist of the month that I'll feature. You'll hear a lot of that artist during the course of the month. A song of the month. Usually one day we pick a song, play it five or six times, not in a row. And, you know, there are other things. Yeah, the New Orleans Jazz Hour. We do special features, West Coast jazz, a history of big band music, you know, whatever comes to mind. We always try to make it entertaining and interesting without my talking too much.
John Greenspan is the host of Good Morning Jazz, which is on KSFR on Wednesday and Thursday mornings from 9 until at noon, until the news at noon.
That's correct. And, you know, we're going to celebrate our 10-year anniversary this week, and hopefully we'll have 10 or 15 or 20 more great years of jazz.
Excellent. It's great to have you here in the Santa Fe Baking Company.
And thanks for all you do for KSFR and for the community, too.
Thank you, John. And we're going to go out today with jazz instead of our regular outro music, Miles Davis and John Coltrane. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.